Really glad to have the chance to talk to you. Wish we could have gotten together before. Before we talk about trombone, why don't you... I think there was a press kit that came with the trombone. I think I left it at home. So, perhaps you can give me a little background about yourself, where you were raised and what it was like growing up.
Well, I grew up in Hollywood, California. I went to Hollywood High. Actually, I went to school with the Mouseketeers, all of them aside from Annette. Annette went to a place called Hollywood Professional, which was a studio dodge to get around the truancy laws. But I grew up in Hollywood. I went to school at Berkeley, and then I came east to school at Columbia. And in New York, I lived in New York for about 10 years, and met my wife here, and we now live in Vermont. We have two kids.
Did you get an advanced degree at Columbia? Is that why you came here?
Master's.
Master's. What, I was just talking to Ray Bradbury, who grew up in Los Angeles. He moved there actually when he was 13.
I think he still lives there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
That's right,
Yeah, so it was interesting. He lived near an MGM Showcase Theater. And so every week they would have previews and glittering audiences, like Norma Shearer and people like that. And he would go and just stand out front and look.
I heard a story about him, and I think about it from time to time. I heard that when electric typewriters were first coming in, he went out and bought one. And he turned it on, and he typed a line, and then the carriage went automatically back, and it made a little whirr, click, click sound. And he thought that the typewriter was commenting on what he would, had written and took it back immediately.
That's interesting. He was fascinating to talk to. And what a marvelous storyteller. I mean, just all I had to do was say, talk, Ray. He did impersonations. And it is wonderful. So, and I was interested in Ray because as a teenager, you know, all teenagers read science fiction. So here I was a teenage fan of his. I read The Martian Chronicles and The Illustrated Man when I was 12, 13, you know. And that was actually my introduction to literature, because he was more than a science fiction writer.
Oh, absolutely.
A poet. He's a poet. He's written about 10 books of poetry.
Well, you know, actually, I have an interest in science fiction, and actually, I was very much inspired by Ridley Scott. And I sat down and wrote an idea for a science fiction movie, which was optioned by Spielberg. You know how the option business goes. They express interest, but it's I'm still waiting for it to be made, of course. But I think I've seen almost every science fiction movie ever made. I still have an idea one time to write a literate novel, science fiction novel. That's not to say that there aren't many of them that are already, but I would like to give it a try someday.
Well, Paul Theroux did. Paul Theroux wrote it was Ozone about 4 years ago. Remember that?
I don't know the book.
Futuristic novel set at a time when most of the United States was off limits to the population because of a plague or something, and an expedition was being sent into the interior to look for someone who had been kidnapped. And it was out-and-out science fiction. That was the only science fiction book he ever wrote, but it was a very literate science fiction book. Ozone, it's called.
My idea for a science fiction novel is it's set at that time when robots, who are virtually indistinguishable from human beings, kill off the last human being. And just before they do so, the human being infects them with a virus, a computer virus, that begins to affect the way they think, and actually, in a way, makes them moving and actually kind of human at the end. But they do some pretty crazy things before the end.
Well, you're such a realistic writer in many respects that would be quite a departure from your usual work, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. It's nice to finish something and move on to something new. There's always a wonderful feeling when you sit down to write a book that's mint new, but you know is something you've never gotten into before.
Well, I was talking to Edna O'Brien. You know her stuff? She's an Irish writer.
Yeah.
She was saying that each book for her that she writes is like the rung of a ladder. And she likes to go on to a new challenge. And so each one is a step upward and more difficult.
I think that's true. I think as time goes on, what happens is your standards I think in a way what makes it more difficult is that your standards increase more than proportionally to the number of books that you've written. That is, they get a little bit higher each time, proportionally higher. And you become much more demanding. As a matter of fact, for trombone, which is in book form relatively short, I wrote 5,000 pages.
Manuscript pages?
Manuscript pages.
5,000, huh? I could see in reading Trombone that this was a book that was pared down to the bone, practically.
There are enormous pieces of it. I mean, by 5,000 pages, that's total output. I mean, that's revisions. That's different versions of the same thing. But also it included an entire section which was dropped, which was set in South America. You know, has to do with bush pilots and things going on in South America. But it was what I really like to do. What really excites me and what I got to do in Trombone was to tell stories. I love to tell stories. That's what it's all about for me. And so the process of writing a book is putting the stories in. And I'll add another story and another story. And at a certain point, I will begin to have to take them out. And that is a very long, painful, nerve-wracking process because, of course, you want to hang on to it. But
yeah, you don't want to waste your words.
No, actually, the in my attic, which is outside the room where I work in Vermont, I keep all the manuscripts, and there's this enormous kind of Kafkaesque kind of warehouse, actually, of papers. And actually, at the end of each book, there's a ceremony I have, which is I take the pages and wrap them up, tie them up with a string, and then wrap them up in paper. And so there are these enormous white blocks, which are actually, I mean, they're occupying a pretty fair size of my attic these days.
So all of the original words, the original manuscripts, before it was pared down.
And also there is a, I have been selling them, there is a collector in New York who
buys manuscripts.
Buys them. Uh-huh. And that also is certainly a motivation for saving just about everything.
An individual? Who buys manuscripts from various authors or just yours?
No, from who has a collection and it buys from authors all over.
Well, let's go back a little bit. I do want to work up the trombone, but let's go back a little bit to your days in Hollywood. You said you loved to tell stories. Did you come from a storytelling family?
No, my father was an engineer who worked in aerospace, and my mother was pretty much at home. My mother came from New England. And I certainly grew up on stories of New England, you know, like all expatriates. I think my mother had an exaggerated idea of what New England was really like. Even when I was growing up, I suspected that there was more to New England than picking blueberries and eating pancakes with maple syrup. But somehow or other, I think those stories took, because after all, I do live in New England now, and I'm married to a woman from New England. No, in California, growing up, one of the things that was there and was a kind of fact of life was the movie business, I would always I would see people from the actors, actresses. I mean, I grew up between Gabby Hayes and a woman named Hilo Hattie, who did the hula on a local TV program called Harry Owens' Hawaiian Holiday. I used to see Steve McQueen on Mulholland Boulevard. I guess it's Mulholland Drive, and he had an AC Cobra, and he used to like to drive cars real fast. And I'd see him up there, and I had a 1956 Chevrolet, and he would he'd come out, and I'd come out behind him, and he'd let me follow him for about 3/4 of a mile, and then he would wave, and then he'd be gone. It was a peculiar way to grow up. I thought that that Hollywood was the way the rest of the world. Was, and it was a great shock to me to realize when I finally got away, but really it is much more of an anomaly than I ever dreamed possible.
You say Hollywood, but is it really a Hollywood?
I guess as a state of mind, there certainly is. geographically, there is too, to some extent. I would say it runs a little bit further out towards the beach, towards Beverly Hills, although a lot of it is centers around that ridge between Hollywood and the Valley, mm-hmm. Between, say, the Hollywood Bowl and Laurel Canyon. There are a lot of screenwriters, directors, actors, actresses, grips, electricians, cameramen who live right there. And also it gave me a definite and practical, I guess is the word I'm looking for, idea of the movie business. I mean, you would drive by Warner Brothers, which looks like a factory. It is, in fact, indistinguishable from an airplane factory. The sound stages look very much like, you know, a Boeing aircraft. And everyone involved did it as a job, and it was a hard job, especially on location. I mean, you know, people got up at 5:30 in the morning and they worked until after dark. It was also it had a peculiar effect on the way I saw movies. I could see from my parents' backyard the Universal back lot, and I could look through field glasses and watch them making movies. I remember them making Spartacus. I remember making, oh gosh, westerns. A lot of movies that were set in Africa. And then I would finally go to the movies, and there would be somebody slogging through the savanna of Africa, and I knew very, very good and well that was right across the street from my parents' house.
You went on to Berkeley. What did you study there?
I studied English. I was there. I graduated in 1967, so I guess I was there in the heyday of Berkeley.
Were you caught up in some of the student rebelliousness there?
I was not in Sproul Hall, but most of my friends were. As a matter of fact, I think I still have Mario Savio's German book at home. It was a very exciting time. It seemed as though all things were possible. It was youth personified. I mean, there was a kind of certainly there was a kind of arrogance to it, or I wouldn't say arrogance so much as innocence. But it was. In many ways, it was a wonderful time. Also, it was a very dangerous time in many ways. I mean, drugs came through there like you wouldn't believe, and I think many people were injured by that. There were a fair number of very talented people I knew who were destroyed by things like LSD. I
mean, did you plan to become a teacher, or did you know at some stage that you wanted to be a writer?
I knew, although I wasn't admitting it to anybody. I knew from a very early age that's what I wanted to do. And I think that's a great advantage if you know what you want to do. I always presumed it was something that I wanted to do. I never imagined what it would be like to make a living as a writer, in which case it becomes not always something that you want to do, but something that you have to do. What happens these days is that, I make a living at it. It takes me about 700 days to write a book, and I usually get paid for about 550 of those. So when I start, I'm about 150 days behind, which I have to make up somehow. My books seem to do fairly well in Europe, and that helps out enormously. Like the last book, Tornado Alley, was a main selection of Euro Club in Italy. Other books have been main selections of Swedish book clubs. The translation market has been pretty good. In addition to here, they go to paper here and don't do that badly.
So you came east to go to Columbia to get your MA, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Again in English?
Excuse me?
Again in English?
Actually, it was a writing program.
They have a terrific... I wanted to enroll in that myself. I found, even at this late age of my life, but it was 2 years and just impossible.
That was a really wonderful thing. It was, we were the first group to go through there, and no one really knew what we were supposed to do or going to do. I met Jean Stafford there, and she took me under her wing. And actually, after the first couple of weeks of classes, she took me aside and said, "I can see that this isn't doing you much good, is it?" By that, she meant that I was a little uncomfortable sitting around in the classroom. And I said, "No, I don't think it's doing me much good." And she said, "Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you come and meet me for a drink every Friday afternoon, and we'll call it quits at that." And so I explored the city, and Jean and I would get together and talk. She really was a wonderful, charming woman who was a great influence on me, not only in her work, from which I've learned a lot, but in the way she allowed me to get close enough to her to see what it would be like to try to spend a life writing well. She was a wonderful, charming, funny woman who would tell me stories about Robert Lowell and A.J. Liebling and... Walt Kelly and things that they used to do in New York. It was absolutely wonderful. And we became very good friends. As a matter of fact, Gene died in the same hospital on the same day almost when my first child was being born. I didn't know she was in the hospital. I knew what she was. I didn't know she was in that hospital, but I was to say that I was upset by her death, is to put it mildly. I mean, she was a great influence on me.
What did you do after you graduated from Columbia?
Oh gosh, those were those days that I think every writer goes through, which you look back on with great chagrin and with great amusement too. I did a little bit of everything. I was a cab driver, a proofreader, a carpenter. I think I must have put up half of the drywall in Soho myself. I sold computers. I was a truck driver. I had a job driving a truck to Key West, where I was a carpenter for a while. Periodically, I would sell a book for a small advance, and I would drop all the things that I had to keep going, to make money. And then when the advance, which is, in those days was very small, ran out, I would be kind of stuck. I'd be a little desperate. I'd have to find something like driving a taxi cab for a while. And then the National Endowment for the Arts, or the Guggenheim Foundation, or something like that would come along. And so I would stop driving a cab and then go out to East Hampton, where there was a house in Gene Safford's backyard, which he used to let me have in the summertime. It was a very bizarre existence in that I would be right at the bottom and then suddenly would be leading this leisurely, kind of comfortable life. And then, of course, the money would run out and I would drop off again. There were about 10 years of that, which was, I can say, looking back on it, some of it is very funny and some of it not so funny, but I think it's for most writers, or a great many writers, it's something that they all go through.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Most of us, I come from a family, my father was a businessman, and the thought of being unemployed for any period was just unthinkable. And so even when I did have moments of unemployment, I immediately scrambled to get my resume out and to get another job. The thought of being able to write and holding out while the money lasts, and then doing something to bring a little more money in this peripatetic existence is foreign to a lot of people, because most people say, well, I've got to get a good job, a good, stable, secure job with security and this sort of thing. So I admire people like you and other writers who actually, what you're doing is taking risk that most people don't.
That's absolutely, and also psychological risk too. I mean, I came from a very similar family. I mean, my father wanted me to go to law school. So it was not only was there the financial struggle and the literary struggle and the struggle to find a market, there's also the psychological difficulty of doing something that the people you care about don't approve of entirely. That cannot be exaggerated. It is a great difficulty. It's a problem.
Yeah, I remember, Craig, my first big job in radio, I was working the midnight shift. And I was so happy to have this job. It was a station in Huntington, West Virginia, an NBC radio affiliate. And I called my father and said, Dad, I have this terrific job, and I'm working overnight. And my father said to me on the phone, he said, sounds unnatural to me. He never did. To this day, he doesn't understand what I do and why I do it.
Well, actually, my father is dead now, and I one of my great regrets is that he wasn't around not only to see his grandchildren, he wasn't able to see me begin to come into my own as a writer.
But he was around when you published your first book.
First books.
Then he probably had a great deal of, at least a degree of jaundiced pride in you.
Well, let's hope so. I mean,
well, speaking of your first books, let's speak about your first books, your first published work. Tell me about that.
Well, I think there's an enormous difference between the first books. There were three of them. There was a book called Turkey Hash, which won the Harper Saxon Prize. There was a book called The Geek, and a book called Incandescence, all of which books I consider juvenilia of a sort. There is one clear dividing line in my life as a writer and as a human being, that is the division between my time when I did not have children and after having children. I realized very shortly after my first daughter was born that one day she was going to read my books. And this had an enormous impact on what I wrote. Before, it was very difficult for me to... it may also be a general matter of just growing up, but it be, before my daughter, first daughter was born, it was difficult for me to come to terms as a writer with really basic things, people loving each other, knowing how to deal with things like passion and attachments of one kind or another. But those things became my subject, the thing that I'm most concerned about after my children were born. I don't know whether it is entirely a matter of knowing that my kids were going to read my books, or whether it's just a matter of growing up a little bit. But there was an enormous change right there. You can see it between Incandescence and a book called The Good Son.
How old are your children now?
My oldest is 13, and my youngest is 8.
There's probably a good chance they'll never read your books.
Well, no, actually, my 13-year-old is plowing through them all.
Really?
And actually, she's just finished a book called The Good Son. And she's waiting to read Trombone, by the way. No, it is. She's a great fan of a book called The Good Son, and it means a lot to me. I can't tell you how pleased I was when she came to me and said, well, she liked the book. She's a great reader. She reads Joseph Conrad. She's seems to have a knack for it. Every now and then, she makes noises about wanting to be a writer. And that peculiar reversal of roles, I find that maybe my father wasn't so wrong after all. Maybe maybe medical school or law school wouldn't be a bad idea. But
I think he would be very pleased to have your daughter be a writer. It's a good thing to do.
It is. That's true. It can be, especially in the beginning, however, it can be very difficult. And as a protective parent, maybe that experience is something one would like to shield one's children from.
Well, medical school is not so easy either.
That's right.
Well, and Trombone, such a beautiful book, and I knew that you had to come from California, because you evoke the California landscape so well. And I've never been to Chinatown in Los Angeles, but the way you describe Chinatown in Los Angeles is just the way I would see Chinatown in my mind. It's the way you can see it in New York, for example, with the little narrow streets and this sort of thing. And I guess most of the action is actually set in Bakersfield, is that right?
It's Bakersfield, Chinatown in Los Angeles, and in Las Vegas. When I was about 13 or 14, maybe 15 years old, there was a friend of mine who was a Chinese, a young man who used to take me to Chinatown, and we would go to the movies down there, which I didn't understand at all. There were the subtitles were for, I guess, what they were was different dialects of Chinese. And he would take me around and point out the fan tan parlors and various places and tell me who was doing what. And I've been thinking about those stories for 25 years, and I think that they're behind the impulse to write about Chinatown the way I have. The landscape of California is something that or the impulse to describe landscape. I think somebody said someplace that a landscape is character. I think it's Henry James who said that. I'm not positive though. And it's true that it's something I like to do. I delight in writing about the natural world. I also like to describe the natural world in such a way that reflects on the people who are in it. And in this particular book, because I've taken a kind of interest in using suspense to power a book about real concerns between men and women, between human beings. I've wanted to use a kind of a Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett kind of suspense, and that certainly is explains partially how the natural world appears in Trombone. It's something like the world of Raymond Chandler and as he describes Los Angeles. It has behind it a sense of menace. There was a reviewer the first review of trombone was a man by the name of Cryer at Newsday, who pointed out, and I was very pleased by his description of the book, pointed out that behind it there's an underlying sense of menace in that kind of Raymond Chandler kind of way. And I think that's true. I think it comes not only from the characters and from what they're doing, but from the environment in which the book is set, which is, like I say,
well, yeah, all through the book, the reader finds himself waiting for something to happen, waiting for the inevitable crisis that is going to erupt and change their lives. And it does happen, of course. But essentially the book is also the relationship between Ray and Dean. Is it Golance? Am I pronouncing
it? Golance.
Golance. A father and son relationship, and a rather complicated one. Maybe you could address that for me.
Well, first of all, one of the things I wanted to write about was, it is the story of Trombone was meant to be, or I meant it to be, an essentially modern story, in that one of the facts of modern life is that we're not quite so anchored to right and wrong as we used to be, or we don't have a clear messages about right and wrong. Things in the modern world have become a little vaguer, and in this story, really, it's a story of a young man, and also of a young woman too, finally discovering and acting upon what they have discovered to be right. The moral problem is that a young man whose father is an arsonist, and his father confuses young man's participation in crime with affection. And this puts the young man in an incredibly difficult position. What does he owe his father? Where does loyalty come into his life? What is the right thing to do under these circumstances? Of course, the morality of circumstances are compounded by the fact that both father and son end up interested in the same woman, same young woman, and of course they have widely differing attitudes towards her. The father sees her as a distraction, whereas the son falls in love with him. Also, it's a great difference between the father and son about that, too.
So it is a story about a son trying to reconcile his relationship with his father. And I think the epitome of that is found in the fact that the father plays the trombone, goes up in the attic at moments of loneliness or sorrow or disappointment, plays the trombone. And eventually, when he decides to buy an instrument for his son, his son also selects the trombone. I mean, I thought that was a very significant development in the story in terms of their relationship, because it told a lot about it.
The for all the difficulties, which are, I mean, you know, are severe and even violent. I mean, these are two people who are burning down buildings together, and one of the difficulties in burning down buildings with somebody else is that it's very easy to make a mistake and have the building burn down too soon, in which case somebody gets killed. But for all the difficulties, the moral and otherwise, the son loves his father. I mean, this is a story about somebody who was, if he didn't, there would be no story. The son would simply say, well, I'm sorry, I'm clearing out. But that's not the case. And as an indication of that love, he wants to have for himself one of the most beautiful things of his father's life, which is, of course, playing the trombone. It's the father's way of addressing his own yearning. And so when the time comes, of course, the son wants to participate in that.
I have this theory that, and I was talking to Benjamin Cheever the other day. He's written his first novel, and the central character is based on his father, John Cheever. And so we spent a lot of time talking about fathers, and I think both of us agreed. Now, you may take exception to this, but we tended to agree that it is just about impossible to reconcile a relationship with your father, that somehow there's always this gulf. Fathers have an expectation of you that can never be fulfilled, that they don't realize that you're actually a different person. I was never, although my father's still alive, he's a very old man now, I was never able to reconcile my relationship with him, even though I love him. And Benjamin Cheever felt the same way about his father, John. You have, since you have a father-son relationship in here, this is very significant. Maybe you could talk to me about that.
I think that I agree that it is a very difficult relationship to reconcile, and I'm not so sure that it should be or is entirely necessary. I think that what happens is that after a certain point, the significant thing is that a sense of power or a sense of authority has been passed from one generation to another. But at a certain point, you know you're in charge and your father isn't anymore. It's a very complicated moment. It involves struggle. It involves, oh gosh, it involves education, knowledge, experience. But that moment does come. And like all knowledge worth having, it comes at a price. And I think the price is a kind of pang. And that pang, of course, has to do with the human condition, that we know that there are certain things we're just not going to get out of it. That doesn't it doesn't stop our recognizing the longing for it. I would love to have had my father understand my books and read them with great enthusiasm. But after a certain point, you realize that's not going to happen. But nevertheless, you're going to go on writing and getting and you're going to get a pleasure out of it. And then that your life has its own imperative that you're going to act on independently of your father. And as I say, it's a very complicated moment, but it's critical that it does happen, and mostly it does.
Well, I wrote a novel that was published by St. Martin's Press in 1988. It was a thriller centered around H.L. Mencken. And I sent my father a copy of this book. He never said anything to me about it, one way or the other. In fact, he was quoted, my brother said that he couldn't finish the book. He didn't understand it, couldn't follow it. And he never commented one way or another about it. And one time I went down, they live in Houston, I went down to visit, and I saw my book out on the coffee table. And on the cover of the book was a ring made by water, or liquid. And it was obvious that they were using the book as a coaster. And I didn't, you know, in a way, I didn't think much of it at the time, but later I began to think, you know, shouldn't they have had some sort of pride? I mean, it's very hard to publish a book. It's hard to write it, and it's hard to find someone to publish it. And I just kind of wondered about that. And there again was this gulf where I don't think he understood what I was doing. Whether it's in my job as a journalist or as a writer or anything else, it's though I came from another planet in some respects.
I hope you sit down and write another novel. I hope you go home this afternoon and begin.
Yeah,
well, then the flip side of that is that I have an uncle who lives in Cleveland, and I was very, very proud and pleased, really deeply pleased, to hear that he would go to the library. He's retired now. And he would go to the library, and a local public library, and take the book off the shelf and to show it to people who were in the library and say, I want you to know that my nephew wrote this book. I mean, you feel great. I mean, that's what you want. Also, I've had the experience of somebody writing to me to say that they liked a book of mine so much that they stole it out of the library.
That's
kind of
a
back. Please put it back. You know?
Please. How did it happen that you moved to Vermont?
Well, my wife worked for CBS News for 7 years.
Did you meet her in New York?
She was in New York.
So you lived in New York for quite a while?
New York, yeah, we lived here together for, well, we weren't living together when she was at CBS. We lived together just when she was at the end of her time at CBS. But when she was traveling, she was always looking for the ideal place to live. And I had seen a fair amount of the country in the way the young writers do, getting around one way or another. And Vermont was the one place that neither one of us objected to, and a place that I also had some connection to. My great-grandfather had a farm in West Rutland. And also, as I say, I grown up with stories of New England, and I felt somehow drawn to it. And we've been very happy there. The winters are long.
I was going to say, it gets pretty chilly up there.
It certainly is.
But where do you live in Vermont?
We live in a little town called Westminster West, which is north of Brattleboro. It's what real Vermont is called the Sun Belt. It's in the southern part of the state.
Now, is this, do you live in the town, or do you have a country place?
We live, and when people think of living in Vermont in an old farmhouse, they're probably thinking of our house. However, I'm sure they weren't thinking of what it's like to heat it in the wintertime. It's like flying an airplane, or two stoves and a furnace, and you've got to be adjusting it all the time. I'd like to live in Vermont for the summertime. I do a fair amount of fly fishing, and there's some wonderful streams in central Vermont. I have a shell, a row in the Connecticut River. It's wonderful to get out there at 7 o'clock in the morning when it's just like glass.
I see you work that into trombone, too.
I've been trying to work that in for a long time. And also, during the wintertime, when it's snow up to our eyeballs, it's a great time to write a book.
Do you do any teaching in addition? So writing is a full-time job?
It's a full-time job.
What about your social life in Vermont? It's such a rural area. Get around it. Is it hard to meet up people?
Oh, not at all. There's more people up there that I know and have things to do with than I can shake a stick at. And you'd be amazed at how many writers there are up there. Joe McGinnis is a friend of mine who's in Williamstown. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go to a baseball game.
I've interviewed Joe McGinnis.
There's a minor league team in Pittsfield called the Pittsfield Mets, and we're going to go to that. John Irving is an old friend of mine.
I've interviewed John Irving.
Who lives now in Dorset. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have dinner with him next Monday night. There are other writers around. Valerie Martin.
I've interviewed Valerie Martin. Keep going.
Valerie lives in a town called Montague, which is close to Northampton. I see her from time to time. Occasionally, I'll talk on the phone with Howard Mosier. Mostly, we go fishing together. Howard Mosier is a writer who lives up on the Canadian border.
Now, I'm not familiar with him.
There's another a writer up there who teaches at Dartmouth, Ernie Hebert, I see from time to time.
I've interviewed him. He's really captured the New England spirit in his books.
He's a wonderful guy, too. I like him a lot. So there's a whole bunch of people up there who, writers, in addition to just ordinary people. And frankly, after aside from the few good friends I have who are writers, that's John and Joe McGinnis and Valerie, and it's a good idea, I think, for a writer not to to be too caught up in literary life. It's a good idea to know people who just have ordinary lives. I feel very comfortable with those people.
Do you have a regimen? Do you work every day?
I will be at work. It will depend upon whether or not it snowed and how much snow there is to shovel in the wintertime, but usually about from 8:30 to about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And actually, as time has gone on, now there's what my wife calls the second shift, which is the business part of it, keeping track of foreign publishers, answering letters, looking after tax exemption forms from Europe and things like that. There's a whole other thing that goes on, say, between 4:30 and 6. It's a real full-time job. And occasionally, I'll do a little magazine work, whether it's a piece on rowing for Outside Magazine, or it looks like a Men's Journal is going to send me to an isolated pond in Maine to do a little brook trout fishing. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. that uses up time too.
And in terms of ideas, I guess it's. Some people say, I'd like to write a book, but I can't think about anything to write. But it seems to me you've got a whole lifetime to draw on.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that I have a notebook in which there are enough ideas to keep me going for the next 30 years. If I never had another idea, I'd be set from now until I was 75 without any trouble whatsoever. My problem is trying to find the time to write the ideas I have. As a matter of fact, my wife can see it. She can see the look in my eyes when I've got another idea. she can tell that it's there's another book cooking.
Well, Craig Nova, it was terrific that I had the opportunity to talk to you. And Trombone, it's just a beautiful, beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for coming in.